This is an interview with William Sullivan, the Youngstown State University Oral History Program, concerning the shutdown of the Youngstown Student Group by Philip Bracey. Sheet 2 offices on Monday, April 13th, 1981, at 1 p.m.
Practiced law, served a term on the Warren City Council, was an unsuccessful candidate for Maryland. Then moved to the Trumbull Council of Governments, and that began my involvement with the steel industry. From the Honey Trumbull Council of Governments, and elected the Great Economic Development Agency, ultimately the Steel Communities Coalition, and then into the private consulting business.
How did the questions of economic development
become involved? Well, it included roots, I guess, in three different pots, as it were. And the regional planning entities, the regional public council, that is, and the regional transportation study. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, who was putting money into both groups, really forced a merger of the Council of Governments and the Transportation Society. At the same time, the Department of Commerce was trying to convince the city of Youngstown to create an economic development component. And I had gotten fairly deeply involved in environmental matters and trying to reach some kind of a compromise between the steel industry and EPA and some kind of joint program between the steel industry and the community on water pollution. So, in order to solve political problems and also to keep working on the environmental side, the Economic Development Agency was created. Finding some middle ground between the Environmental Protection Agency and the steel.
What service area did you
Mahoning and Trumbull County was the beginning of the service area, and really effectively that's all we were covering.
Okay, your governing philosophy, though, was basically to retain steel as opposed to diversification?
Well, no. When we started out with a specific task, which was to ensure that the EPA did not close the steel mill. That was the principal task at the start. At the same time, we began on a technical assistance grant, and we took a look at the final report of the technical assistance grant to find that it had a number of components that went beyond the steel industry, and that affected the steel industry was a relatively minor part of it. We were looking at background conditions that affected all industries. The one thing that the philosophy at the start was that retention, not of steel, but of industry, what was here, was more important than a lot of efforts to attract new industry. Principally on the feeling that we had some chance of saving some of the industry that was here, and it was going to be very difficult to bring it into the dream, so that kind of a cost-benefit analysis, the hours put into retention, paid a bigger dividend than the amount put into moving new industry. Also, at that point, there was the Youngstown Urban Growth Association, and the company working on the effect of new industry.
Was there any forewarning of the shutdown?
Of course, forewarning of the shutdown. What we all about for 5 years, but nobody wants to pay any attention to what we were saying. There was no clear warning that this was going to happen in that particular number, in that particular number. But anyone who was following the problems of steel at all knew that we were fighting very much an uphill battle, and that the national economic conditions were making it more difficult every day.
Immediately following the shutdown, were you
contact with any local governmental unit for assistance as far as trying to coordinate. Not really, it was chaotic after we shut down. We did not have a substantial amount of work beforehand that could have made a major difference in literally acting more quickly. Remember that by this time, before the closing, we had already obtained the first Title IX grant and had done an adjustment plan, which had two components, which having been in place would have made, I think, a substantial difference. One was a community insurance fund that was designed to make up lost tax dollars in the event of tax court. That was approved and funded, but the EDA couldn't get around to letting the regulations run out of the year. The other one, and one that EDA would not fund, foolishly, was the community section, which was to sit down with the community leaders and develop what amounted to an economic disaster plan in the individual community. So if the plan doesn't occur, somebody would know exactly what to do, so they don't know what to say, and avoid the panic. I don't think EDA ever really believed the bill was going to occur. I don't think anybody in the federal establishment did. They were wrong.
Could you tell me the events leading to the Beadle report, the so-called Beadle report?
Well, George Beadle was a transportation engineer. He began his work with us when he looked at the most important issues, and he started work on looking at the feasibility of organizing unit train delivery of coal and iron ore to the mills in the valley. George had left Carter and we went into more detailed work on the unit train under the Title IX grant. George was selected as a consultant to do that. He is a bright-gauge guy, and at the point of the closing, he had very much had the confidence of all of the dispatching to the people. So we spent a lot of time with George, a lot of time going back and forth to Washington, a lot of time talking with ourselves about what to do. I guess you could think the interest in reopening to a meeting that occurred at the start of the field house not long after the closing, not knowing the exact
thing. Would it have been the same week?
Or? No, a couple of weeks after that meeting. Anyway, if whatever the meeting was, there was a number of speakers, actually could have been more than 10 minutes. We're doing the industrial parks being involved and everything else. And I got up and posed what I thought was a logical question, and that was whether anybody was so sure that this mill couldn't operate that we should write it off without any further questions. I suggested then that the only thing we knew was that this was equipment and men across the street. One week it was making a seat all, and another week there wasn't. We didn't really know any more than that at that point. And the first step should be to find out whether the closing was inevitable, irreversible, or not. Unfortunately, if I had it to do again, I'm not sure that I would publicly ask that question. I think it's a question that should have been addressed. In retrospect, it may well have been better addressed privately than publicly. What we were talking about, and I think what we ultimately did in the Beadle report, was a rational analysis of the question of can it steal. What it gave birth to was an emotional response that it challenged steal.
I think the public effort really may have hindered what, a rational evaluation of whether it should or should not be a threat, wasn't
it? Well, I mean, unfortunately, it became a proving ground for a lot of for the agendas of a lot of national agencies that are entities that have real interest in Mahoney Valley. This problem was problematic. We got off on an emotional binge that we're going to reopen mills at any cost, and one of these things where it was as important to blame somebody for the closing as it was to do something about it. I think that the Beale Report represented not only the first hard work that was done on the issue of a possibility of reopening hard in the sense of hard data that one could value. It was also the last hard work that was done. Dallying on, the federal government spent another, $350,000. Never answered any of the questions the Beale Report raised. Never moved the state of the art in terms of what would be required to reopen once that the non-wage work there 30 days after the started work.
Following the shutdown, approximately October 28th and 29th, there was a field crisis meeting. You did a presentation at that meeting. Can you tell me what that was, what your presentation dealt with?
Well, this was the meeting at the church?
Yes, with the religious leaders. There were no politicians per se.
Well,
if
I remember, and on. So we concluded that the real decision on whether Steele lived or died in Mahoney Valley is going to be made not in Mahoney Valley, but in Washington. And that it was not likely that we would be able to speak loudly enough in Washington to make the kinds of changes that we felt were necessary. We also had a strong feeling that there were others in the same position. I had been invited to speak at a number of different places around the country who were having problems. Buffalo had already suffered an announced closing, and I'd been to Buffalo on several occasions. So I picked up the phone and called Jack Hunter, who was in there of Youngstown, and Tom Barrett, who was Mahoney County Commissioner, and said, we got to pull a meeting together. Then through a friend of mine in Pittsburgh, I contacted the Allegheny County Commissioner, and I called the then county executive in Erie County, New York, Ned Reagan, who had got to know on some trips to Buffalo, and said, look, let's see if we can pull something together. I want to put your names on a telegram convening a meeting. He said, great. So we sent out a telegram to, I forget the exact number, 35 cities or something like that, and about 28 showed up for a meeting in Washington. And really, going to Washington, I had no intention of forming a permanent, anything like a permanent organization, but we did, in fact, end up creating an entity that was to have an effective life of 2 or 3 years.
How did the organization evolve over the 2 or 3 years?
I'm not sure it did. That was one of the problems with the organization. It was organized around elected public officials, which is good, except that elected public officials will not give an organization much continuity because they tend to change. Some of the elected public officials resisted attempts or suggestions that staff made to broaden the base by including organized labor and Chamber of Commerce and community groups to turn the Steel Community Coalition into a real community structure. I think had that been done, and had the difficulty of how you fund an agency like that at an adequate rate without selling your soul to somebody or other, could have been resolved, then we might well have ended up with a permanent organization. Whether that permanent organization would have been effective in the long run is, of course, another question. It's interesting that the community, in the fullest sense of that, has no lobby. There is no lobby that is broad enough to cover that kind of community interest. There still isn't. It's difficult to hold that kind of a lobby together. And you need more time than we had to get it in place. We were making a great deal of progress on a lot of circumstances conspired to really make it impossible to continue the way we were. And when I left, for whatever reason, the pieces simply weren't picked up. The Pittsburgh interests were very interested in running the organization. Unfortunately, when it got to Pittsburgh, it collapsed.
Then what I was talking about also was there any formal organization, like did you have offices? And
oh, sure. It was established as a nonprofit corporation. It was staffed. It had did a lot of fairly formal work, did a substantial amount of testifying before Senate congressional committees and other public bodies, had a very active newsletter. It was, in all sense, a very active organization during its brief life. It still exists on paper. It has, I think, for all practical purposes, expired.
How was the organization funded?
By dues from the community, contributions from the industry, from organized labor, from many places again. One of the difficulties was that we tried to balance the money coming in so that we would not be open to an accusation that we were owned by the industry or by anybody else. In a sense, is silly. I think an organization like that probably should get every penny it can out of the industry, because it is only the industry who has got the money available to spend to keep something like that alive. God knows the communities who are suffering a cutback in revenues as it is can't provide the money. who else has the interest? It's got to be the steel workers union and the steel manufacturers.
If I could go back to, you were president of the Steel Community Coalition?
Yes.
And could you tell me who like the, some of the people in between?
Well, Jim Flaherty was then an Allegheny County Commissioner, was co-chairman. The other co-chairman was Ned Reagan, who was the Erie County Executive. Father Stanton was treasurer. Vice President, was during the vice president, one was Stan Schmick from the Mayor Canton. Jack Hunter, I think secretary at the start. The staff that we developed was built off of the Rita staff. People shifted over on the steel community side. Plus, we added a press person, a person, Barbara Depp, who was in a one of the amount of time, was responsible for the newsletter.
What were your feelings about the Ex-National Coalition's efforts as far as community worker buyouts? Did you favor that?
Well, I thought they were sold a bill of goods. I don't have any feelings on worker ownership one way or another, except that I know that you cannot change the basic economics of a business simply by transferring ownership from one group to another. Doesn't change the economics. Doesn't make the blast furnace any newer. Doesn't make the open hearth any more efficient. Doesn't expand the market. Doesn't do any of the things that have to be done. Community ownership, I have deep philosophic problems with. And I think it was very, very foolish for the Ecumenical Coalition to have been sucked into a position of getting on board a consultant who obviously had a preconceived solution to the problem. Well, I incidentally made those thoughts known before the fact as well as after.
What were your feelings about the, and did you participate in any way in the idea of, I believe it was NEDVAC, the National Research Steel Center? Were you in any way involved in this?
Well, not. Not aside from the speech I wrote for a political candidate several years before that suggested something very much like that. The problem was that they were never, NEDVAC was never able to get the industry interested. And I think that in no small part reflects its academic orientation. It was put together really by someone who was far too removed from the situation to understand the industry's needs and to understand what you might be able to sell. I think ultimately some kind of at least a basic industry think tank is going to have to come into place in this country. I don't think it's going to come into place in Youngstown, Ohio. I think another one of the problems was that there was not a universally recognized university setting in which to place it. If you're talking about putting something at Harvard or MIT or Yale or Columbia, you got a built-in follow-up. When you try to do it at Youngstown State University, you know how much tougher road to hoe. We're just kidding ourselves at the beginning. A hard fact of life. And I also think the industry always thought, well, why the hell should we, if we want to do a center, why would we do it in Youngstown when we're closing down there anyway?
But do you think the idea itself has merit?
Well, I would be careful about how I said that. I think that the need for some kind of steel industry-wide, nationwide R&D effort in steel. And R&D not just in the mechanical sense, but also in the economics of the industry and a lot of different areas. I think that's very much needed. One of the things that really bothered me going to Washington at the time this problem was set of tight was I always expected that I was going to find the guy in the green nightshade somewhere in the bowels of the Commerce Department who really understood the steel industry. Well, I wasn't there, and we didn't find him. That bothered me. We don't understand it well enough. But I certainly do not have much of a brief for the specific iron and steel research center that was proposed.
On May 24th of 79, the coalition project was officially put to rest, if you will. Aside from that, those efforts that took place at that period of time, do you have a hopeful view of the future of Mahoning Valley?
Well, I have a mixed view. We're putting some steel components back into place now. The Youngstown Steel Project put a mini mill in the old Campbell Works open hearth. It's a good solid project. We're working on a small seamless mill. It'll be a good solid steel project. I think that steel is probably bottomed out in the Mahoning Valley now, and that there will be a modest increase in steel's role in the economy over the next 10 or 15 years. We have so much of the, to use a word I hate, infrastructure in place to support the steel industry that it makes good sense for steel-related companies to locate here, and there will be some growth, I think. Plus the fact that the remaining steel companies are all very strong economically, good production facilities. So there'll be more good news on the steel side. I would say that in Mahoning County, there'll be more bad news in the remainder of the economy. There are a number of shoes that I believe are yet to fall in terms of plant relocations and plant closings in Mahoning County. I think Youngstown is in for another decade of population decline. I suspect that some of the delayed reaction of relocation of service entities that generally follows a manufacturing decline will hit during the next decade. Trumbull County is going to be like the man who goes from 30 to 40, and at 40 is responsible for his own face. The way they looked at 1990 is going to be by and large determined by how Trumbull County's private and public leadership acts in the next 10 years. If the city of Warren could possibly quit fighting with its neighbors over utility extensions and annexation, if the private leadership could exert itself once again, I think the growth potential for Trumbull County is very, very strong. Will that happen? Damned if I know. I've been expecting it for 20 years. I just don't know. I do know that we are beginning to get into an area, a period that is very, very dangerous for the valley. And that's the period in which the out-migration of our leadership is going to be most apparent. I think I'm beginning to see it now. I'm beginning to see professional people wondering whether they should stay. That's when things really get sticky. If we cannot hold on to that leadership, then the decline has got a long way to go yet.
I remember that in Pittsburgh, when they were going through their various sundry changes, they had like Nolan Banks and some of the foundations to fall back on. What kind of base do you think that Youngstown has as far as, to drop in as far as leadership and the kind of direction that perhaps Mayor Lawrence had back in the late 50s?
Well, what it requires is a Mayor Lawrence. You've got to have some political leadership who has enough credibility in the private sector, enough drive and enough imagination to go out and identify with people in the private sector who can make a difference and then pull them all together. It's very difficult to work it the other way for somebody in the private sector to be the drive, although it can happen that way. We're suffering a little bit, I think, from executive revolving doors. General Motors is now by far the largest employer in the valley. The managers at Packard and worse at GM Lordstown aren't here for very long, not usually long enough to develop a real long-term stake in the community. Republic is a little better, but not a lot. We've had two district managers in the past, three in the last 10 years. So I don't know where the leadership's coming from. The old line home-owned companies have by and large been sold off. This certainly is not the community to practice law in that it was 20 years ago when you had a lot of home-owned companies to represent. I guess the bright side is that a lot of entrepreneurs are looking at the area now as a place where maybe they can make some money, and maybe out of that crew of new entrepreneurs will come the kind of aggressive leadership that we need. We don't. We have not, I think, historically treated those who would lead very well. There's a certain tendency to say, well, I don't want to lead today, but I might want to tomorrow, so don't you try anything before then. And that syndrome seems to me to be very active, so that when somebody gets out front and tries to do something, he almost inevitably becomes the brunt of criticism from his peers. And I'm not concerned about criticism of the press or the criticism of some dissident group, but the peer criticism takes its toll.
Okay, and finally, are there any facts or anything that you feel is important that should come out about that period that I haven't asked you about? And if so, what would that be?
Which period?
The shutdown period from 77 through 70.
Well, I think the biggest problem was that the shutdown occurred at a period in the history of the valley where there was no established political leadership, and consequently nobody was in charge. That was too bad, and there was a great deal of fear on the part of a lot of people that an imagined rival would end up in charge. So I can't really think of any political figure who distinguished himself by his service during that time. Enormous amount of confusion. Horrible, horrible reluctance to deal in fact. It was, for me, the most difficult period I have ever gone through. It frankly seriously dampened my enthusiasm for trying to exercise any leadership here. I think that there are a number of others who would say the same. I think the congressman's activities were reprehensible. The fact that a Catholic bishop should have to get the congressman and the mayor and the district director, the steel workers, all to put it in writing that he would be the man in charge is, it's terrible. It was almost as if we were negotiating a peace treaty.
You're speaking of the mail, Graham, of approximately December of 77, where there was a meeting, and then they had agreed that the coalition would be the point.
Right, and that just, those sorts of things shouldn't develop. That leadership gap, then plus just a very bad mistake in giving the work over to the Center for Economic Alternatives. We simply were not competent to do the job that needed to be done at that time. It's too bad. Now, there were also a lot of bad actors running around Washington making promises, I think, principally on the basis that they would never have to keep them. They were, of course, right. they were banking on the fact that the Valley would never get its act together, and it didn't. I think one of the real difficult things is that if the individuals involved were to sit back and say, what could I have done differently that would have changed things? Probably, without exception, they would say, well, there's nothing I could have done differently. And there may be some truth in that. The congressman, for example, did what he thought was necessary to protect his political life. I think he was wrong, as it turned out, the voters agreed with me. But he was acting according to his best understanding of the situation and what he thought he must do. And I think he went right down the line. The bishop certainly did not agree to the Center for Economic Alternatives in order to torpedo the project. He thought that's where he had to be. It was just a number of miscalculations and errors on the part of a lot of people, none of whose motives I question. And here we are.
Is there any specifics, you mentioned Congressman Corning, that acts that you felt specifically, I don't really want to put you in too much of a spot, but that you felt were, that should not have been handled the way they were handled, for instance?
Well, creation of the Mahoning Valley Economic Development Committee at that point was designed to squeeze out the Western Reserve Economic Development Agency, which unfortunately was the only agency with any expertise in the area. It was done, I think, because Carney was convinced I was going to run for Congress. He had no intention of doing it, which we tried to communicate to him through a number of what we thought were unimpeachable sources. Didn't work. Carney viciously attacked the Beadle report, made it impossible for Beadle to continue to do the work, and yet he was the only one who had the information and had the report to come from. I guess Chuck Carney, as much as anyone, was responsible for the choice of Gar Elpowitz, because there wasn't any place else to go. Then Carney's hostility to Beadle and to me and to a number of others also hampered the Center for Economic Alternative in that they could not subcontract some of the technical work back to the people who had the information because that wasn't politically acceptable. So you got this kind of giant circus going. Now, I don't know that we would have come up with an answer that would have worked any better. I think we would have done a hell of a lot faster because we were closer to it.
Okay, thank you very much for taking time this afternoon.
Anytime.